Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
Today on Weather Geeks, we're talking trash, but this conversation doesn't have anything to do with your favorite sports team. We're taking a deep dive into our world's oceans with Dr. Jenna Jambeck of the University of Georgia to track down what happens to those plastics and other disposables we use on a daily basis. Is this problem just a matter of countries recycling more, or does the problem expand into the way we manage waste altogether? We'll answer these questions, plus we'll discuss exactly how these materials are entering our oceans and how these millions of metric tons of trash are affecting the world's ecosystems. It's all next on Weather Geeks. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard, also from the University of Georgia. And Jenna, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And let me just start off before we really dive in to just say that I'm a really big fan of Dr. Jenna Jambeck. She's really a great colleague, and she's changing the world. And I really believe that. I'm not just saying that to kind of inflate this topic here. This is a serious issue, and I want to kind of dive into it. But first, tell us how you got into doing what you do.
Yeah, that's a question I get because I've been working in solid waste management, trash, rubbish, garbage, whatever you want to call it, for over 20 years. And people ask, you know, why did you do that? And I have had an interest in the environment since I was very young and went into environmental engineering. And in that space, and I also teach about drinking water treatment, wastewater treatment, and this integrated waste management approach. When I took my class, so in college, my professor who taught my...
Now, where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Florida.
Oh, no!
I know! In that part, we're rivals.
That's right.
anyway, friendly rivals.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, so I took this class, and I was just fascinated. The professor did a wonderful job. He was very enthusiastic about the subject. And in Gainesville at the time, they were trying to site a new landfill. And people were so passionate about their opinion about this new landfill, what we're going to do with our waste. And I thought about all the choices we make every day and how that actually impacts this whole system. So it wasn't just a design with, you know, pen and paper or at a computer with the AutoCAD. It was actually people and a really close involvement of those people. And to this day, that's why this field really fascinates me.
Yeah, and so you've really kind of taken it and run with it. And by the way, I want to mention also that Dr. Jambeck is a National Geographic Explorer. Talk to us a little bit about what that means and what that's going to imply for your research going forward.
So it's really exciting. So National Geographic has a campaign that they started, and this is the Planet or Plastic campaign, and their June issue focused on this topic. And we were featured in that along with other scientists and researchers. And they also were giving out some grants. And so I was able to get a grant to become a National Geographic Explorer and do work in Vietnam with the independent and informal waste management sector there. So millions of people around the world in other countries actually sort of informally or independently work managing waste. They're unrecognized, their working conditions are terrible, and we're trying to understand how to improve that and their role in actually kind of managing the waste and keeping it out of our ocean, and can we scale that?
Right. Now, as you were talking, a question comes to mind. Did you grow up as a child or perhaps in school or around an environmentally conscious family or...
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, and 9 miles out of that small town in a house that was actually supposed to be just a cabin. My parents divorced when I was very young, and my mom decided to live in that house. But I saw my dad very often, too, and he ended up moving to Florida, and he lived right on the coast in Southwest Florida. And so I grew up on a river in this tiny town outside all of the time, or in Florida, sort of on the coastline. And both of those things really built this environmental ethic in my childhood.
Any science projects in your history along these lines? Just curious, because I did my early science project on weather, and that's kind of what, I imagine you were all over the place.
Yeah, I did. Well, no, I used to, my mom actually was like, I knew you were going to be a scientist, because you would sit and just study things. And then I also remember taking this tiny pewter, I think it was my brother's baby dish, and going into the bathroom and taking like talcum powder and perfumes and luckily nothing toxic, but making all these little mixtures and seeing what would happen. And then like mud pies as outside and there, and I don't know why I thought, you know, just mixing and doing a lot of that was fascinating.
I used to do the same thing. And by the way, we learned before the podcast that Dr. Jembeck and I have shared a similar dislike for all things condiments like mayonnaise and mustard too.
That is true.
But we digress. So I want to really get now into your study. So one of the interesting things about what you and your group, the Jembeck Research Group at University of Georgia, has been doing is trying to track or understand or quantify how much waste is coming from the land and into the oceans. First of all, tell us how that differs from how previous accounting of trash in the ocean or waste in the ocean has been, and then why your study is important.
Sure. Yeah. So historically, when this issue first began to be studied, it was marine biologists and oceanographers, and they were going out into the ocean and seeing the plastic and then saying, oh, well, how much is here? So they started sampling the ocean surface and, you know, sampling different areas and finding plastic. What was different about the work that we were doing was saying how much is actually going in. And we know that the sources from on land are significant. Luckily, it wasn't just me. I was a part of an international working group on this issue, too, out of NCs at UC Santa Barbara. So we had a lot of great minds on this. And we knew that there are various sources on the land, but that our regular waste that we generate every single day is probably significant. And so we sort of went about quantifying that. And really, it's all about looking at countries all around the world that have a coastline and then the quantity of waste that's produced per person, the quantity of that that's plastic. And then from there, we look at how waste is really managed there or mismanaged. There may be inadequate facilities for actually managing waste, or you have people that just litter. So both of those things end up with waste mismanaged on the land. And then from there, weather comes into play, and that would be like wind and rain and, you know, actions to get the waste actually into a waterway or into the ocean.
I was going to actually ask about that because this is Weather Geeks. And so we take all types of angles on weather and climate on the podcast. And so I really was wanting to get into sort of what is sort of the, or if any, are there any weather and or climate angles to any of this?
For sure.
Yeah.
So really that's one of the ways that it's transported. And we see pulse events when we see rain events in terms of the quantity of trash entering the ocean and the quantity of plastic. So the weather, absolutely. It's basically the mechanism of how it can get into the ocean other than someone throwing it, you know, directly.
Sure. So it's a wind blown and then also from flooding that may be put into waterways.
Exactly, yeah, and just even stormwater events. Okay. So, I mean, the mismanaged waste is often on the roadways, and that's where our water runs, even if it's not a flood event, and into our stormwater systems, which usually drain directly to creeks. Right. Sometimes they go to the wastewater, but not very often. They often drain to creeks. Sometimes there's these trash interceptors, but those definitely have to be monitored because we've seen those sort of even overflow, and so then a catchment becomes sort of almost even a source.
Right.
So it definitely plays a role. Now, climate, there was a new paper that just came out that was showing that there was methane being generated from this plastic. And that was sort of one of the first sort of direct ties to potentially like an off-gassing, contribution. But I think we know that plastic is carbon. It's not supposed to be breaking down in the environment, but we are putting a lot of carbon in places where it wasn't, like floating on top of the ocean. So we don't know.
Right. So this is still one of those sort of frontier research problems.
Absolutely.
I imagine. And methane, as you heard her mention, is a greenhouse gas and is actually significantly more potent as a greenhouse trapping gas than, say, carbon dioxide by about 20 times. But I want to get back to something you mentioned about sources on land. And I'm looking at a graphic here, plastic waste inputs from land into the ocean. And there are these preferred sources. So just walk us through sort of what the sources actually are and their relative contributions here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this definitely describes that mismanaged waste that I was talking about. But the first quantity that we look at is the quantity of plastic that's produced in the first place, because that definitely relates to how much we're using. And then that directly relates to how much actually ends up in the waste stream. So that quantity of plastic has been increasing really rapidly. And we now know, as of a publication we did last year in 2017, that there's been 8.3 billion metric tons of plastic produced since we started recording that in 1950.
Wow.
So because a lot of that is used for packaging, we also know that about 6.4 billion metric tons billion. Has become waste.
With a B.
Right. Wow. So we've had to manage that waste. And sort of those of us in the waste management space has been like this new material that has quickly come. And what happened is we just couldn't, you know, develop the infrastructure or, you know, handle that quantity of waste coming or quantity and change in waste coming so quickly. So that's what we've seen, sort of this system that couldn't handle that. And so we see it leaking out. And now in this analysis, we looked at these 192 countries. And of course, we saw then these influencing factors where we saw leakage are like rapidly developing middle income countries where the infrastructure for managing this waste collection, disposal are just not developed and are lagging behind that economic development where people are consuming more and more packaged goods.
Right. Now, something that you've mentioned a few times as we've had this discussion is metric tons. And when we have a flood, for example, Hurricane Harvey, or even recently with Hurricane Lane in Hawaii, oftentimes you'll see people like myself and others try to say, well, that equates, that 36 inches of rainfall equates to this million bathtub gallons.
Yep.
Do you have a way of sort of putting that in context, what metric tons are for the public?
I think what's really nice to understand when we're talking about this plastic is actually individual items don't weigh very much. So there's a lot of volume, but not a lot of mass. And so this 8 million metric tons, I'd like to describe what that would look like.
Yes, please.
Right? So if you and I and everybody in the world were standing along the coastline, the entire coastline of the world, standing hand to hand, we each take up about a foot of space. And we're looking out at the ocean, each one in front of us would have 5 grocery size bags filled with plastic.
Wow.
And that's what we estimate is going into the ocean every year.
Wow.
So that's how you can imagine it.
Now, which raises another question that I have. How do you do this? How do you measure it? How do you know? I mean, obviously you're not capturing every single piece of plastic. You're not sampling it.
Right.
In the same way that, for example, we're not sampling every single inch of rain that drops. So
right.
What are your methods?
So this was, out of this international working group at NCES, this is a data synthesis project. So we were looking at collecting data from all of these countries around the world, and then building this model and making this estimate. And so in those countries, they had measured how much waste people have produced, how much of that is plastic, and then this mismanagement number is based upon inadequate infrastructure. And what we did for that is looked at places that either were using a dump type situation and basically just really lacking in that collection and disposal infrastructure. And then we built a statistical model to predict where we didn't have data, because not every country has collected this data. And this is a problem in this work, because it is challenging, or people hadn't really been paying attention to it before, so people hadn't been collecting this data.
Right.
So kind of even coming out of this paper is the fact that people need to be trying to collect this data and understand it better to improve the kind of estimates as this. This is the first of its kind. We use best available data, but certainly it could be improved.
And I'm just curious, and the answer to this may be no, it's not possible at all. But are there any ways to kind of do any accounting using remote sensing or other ways where you can kind of blur the borders, if you will?
Yeah, no, that is a great question, because collecting this data, it's extensive. So there's been a couple ways to kind of incorporate technology. And we have looked at either remote sensing, satellite imagery, and then there's a project where they're taking those images and then sort of crowdsourcing training machine learning and AI to identify where's plastic. And then, so that could work. That could improve kind of our actual mismanaged waste numbers. And that's pretty much at the cutting edge. And I'm very interested in that. What we've also done at the University of Georgia is people have been doing cleanups for many years, over 30 years. The International Coastal Cleanup with the Ocean Conservancy has been happening. And that has been usually written on data cards. And this was back when I was actually starting this work. I was at the University of New Hampshire before Georgia, but I've been at Georgia 9 years now. And we were like, can we use some technology here? And when smartphones came out, we thought, well, we can make an app for collecting this data. And then it's actually entered at the same time people are collecting it. Because there was this huge lag between all these data cards that then had to be entered and then analyzed. So now we have immediate feedback, and we've crowdsourced people all over the world who are going out and telling us where they're finding litter, picking it up. And then that data, we can, you know, we're getting data in every single day from people.
And this app's available. What's it called, and where can people get it?
Yeah. So it's called Marine Debris Tracker. Okay. It was funded by the NOAA Marine Debris Program, so hence the name. But it really can be used to log litter anywhere in the world. So it's okay to be inland. One of our largest single users is in Missouri, along the Missouri River, so actually in Nebraska. But and that's important because rivers are actually very important conduits for getting this material to the ocean. So Marine Debris Tracker, it's free. Be part of a great citizen science program. Even just opportunistically walking, you know, from your car to your work or wherever, you can tell us and pick up the litter if you can, because that helps solve this problem.
So track it in marine front and
then
pick it up.
Yeah, and then just, tell us what you see. When you pick it up, just tell us what you actually picked up.
And I want to ask you about this because in meteorology, we actually do have quite a bit of crowdsourcing activities. We have things like COCORAS and the MPing, where people are sort of noting where it's raining. Actually, a colleague and I are actually exploring something called aircasting now for air quality. What are your thoughts on crowdsourcing? Because there are some people who say, well, it's nice, COCORAS rain gauge measurements, but the quality control and the liability. But I mean, I find that there is use. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely think there's use. And being funded by NOAA, I've been in citizen science programs that have included those weather programs as well, and they're excellent. And I think, so the data, as long as you get enough of it, so yeah, this might be not the highest quality. We know this is opportunistic observations, but if you get enough of them, we've had over 1.3 million items reported, then you can actually do something with the data. Some of that bias and some of those things kind of, they work themselves out when you have a lot of data. Also, you raise awareness. So people just doing this activity who are interested in science, and you know, you can get school groups who are interested, and so you raise a level of, I think, awareness and appreciation for science. So I think there's other positives than it has to be, you know, the highest quality scientific data. But I think I'm surprised at what we actually can do with the data that's coming in too.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
And we're back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. And I actually have the pleasure today to have a colleague of mine from the University of Georgia, Dr. Jenna Jambach, here. And we're trash talking, but not in the way that you might think. We're talking about a very serious problem for planet Earth, the only planet we have. There's no plan B planet, as you often hear me say. And, you know, Jenna and her colleagues have been looking at this notion of plastic waste in the oceans, how much is coming from land. And she's literally one of the top experts in the world, just to establish some of her credentials. She's also a National Geographic explorer. She's testified before Congress. She's all over the world. She's in the media. So we're talking to someone that knows this topic. And I want to, this is a question that, you know, you and I have talked about personally as just colleagues. Do you deal with trolls in this? You're in social media. You're active in, by the way, tell us where you are on social media so people can follow you. And then do you deal with people that have these sort of alternative theories or ideological perspectives on what you do?
So I'm on Twitter at Jambach Research, and I have a professional Facebook page as well, which is pretty easy to find, Jenna Jambach there. And also our mobile app, Marine Debris Tracker, is at Debris Tracker, and they have a bigger following than me
Go get that. If you're listening, if you're not driving or walking on the treadmill right now, go get that debris tracker and let's help out the Earth.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, this topic, it's, you know, it, at least this is something visible. So, you know, mismanaged trash and plastic ending up in the ocean is quite visible. And so I think There also is pretty much an agreement, you know, we don't want plastic into the ocean. Where we do get some disagreement on this is maybe how you go about doing that. And so that would be sort of where I would see maybe some negative discourse within social media.
So it's about what you do about it. That's the issue with climate change.
I know. It's a bit, yeah.
The solution space.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. People, that's where the discord is, I would say.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, the newest sort of movement with straws has been a bit more controversial than I imagined.
Let's go there. Let's go there. So straws.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of been this real movement towards sort of the elimination of plastic straws.
Right.
And I think even some colleagues of ours at UGA are testing out a new biodegradable straw.
That's my colleague at the New Materials Institute. They're going to use PHA, which is a biodegradable polymer that's not quite available on the market yet. So it's different than this PLA, which is corn-based and is compostable. So there's a lot of nuances there to this biodegradability. But yeah, so the straws, I mean, it raises a lot of awareness, and it's as if it's something that you don't need. But certainly there are people in the disabled community and, you know, elders. And I mean, there are people that do need straws and for some reason, plastic.
Says she needs to drink it. She has very sensitive teeth and she can't drink liquid with ice without a straw. But I was like, it's bad for her.
And sometimes, you know, and the metal straws do get cold. So if you have temperature sensitivity. So I think it's more about those of us that don't necessarily need it. Can we think about it? But my kids love straws. I have kids same age as at least your youngest son.
Sure.
And we, you know, they like straws. So we have metal straws at the house that they can use. And I think it's more about being able to ask for one if you need one. But yes, there have been bans as well. And it's just gotten a bit more controversial than I think it sort of needs to. Does it make a difference? That's the other question I get. Because remember, we talked about that 8 million metric tons. What do straws really contribute? They weigh so little. But the numbers of them are so great. And so we have to think that mass is not the only metric. Weight is not the only metric for measuring this issue. Numbers count, volume, as I kind of said, surface area even. So those things, you know, sort of matter. And of course, if you take one metric, it's going to look a little bit differently. But I think all in all, it's a positive to have this awareness raised.
Oh, I know personally something I've been doing for many years now, and my kids, or at least my son, has sort of adopted the practice, is when I go to a fast food restaurant, I don't take a plastic lid or a straw.
Right.
Yeah, because it's just more plastic in the waste there.
Yeah. And if it's a percentage of what we produce, then if we can lower sort of what we're generating for waste, then our leakage should be less.
Absolutely. What about, I saw something recently about balloons. Our good friend, mutual friend, Seth Bornstein of AP, was talking about the sort of this notion of the big balloon releases that we see that people love. But, you know, that's a hazard, and that's for the ecosystem, but also it's more plastic and, you know.
Yeah, well, especially when you're, you know, purposefully letting it go and knowing it's going to come down somewhere. Interestingly enough, our property near Athens, we end up with a lot of balloons. I don't know if we're in, and this is another weather thing, like, why are they falling out?
Yeah,
you know, we find them
in our
creek.
It might be an interesting study for undergraduate study here.
You know, in our creek, and my husband, when he's, like, mowing the grass and whatnot, he's like, I found another balloon. So, and the strings associated with them, these are all things that in our environment, then once it lands, are not good because the animals interact with it and they cause issues. So again, maybe not a lot of mass. Maybe I don't, you know how many balloon releases happen. I'm pretty excited for our university down the road, Clemson, who has now said they're not going to do their big balloon release that they normally do. And I think that's good. There's other ways you can celebrate and that won't potentially harm, you know.
Very
animals
good.
In the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's, you know, with anything, it's about incremental change and pattern changes and also what you're so good at getting the message out. Now, I want to kind of circle back to the study and some of the research you've done. Is there a way to understand whether there are certain countries or places that are worse culprits than others at sort of the plastic into the ocean?
So I kind of talked about some of the influencing factors, and that's really what we saw with this work. It was a snapshot in time. So I always like to kind of say this, if you think about this analysis on us, our waste management rules and regulations weren't passed until 76. So even I, as a kid, you know, took my waste to like a dump situation, right? So very different in the U.S. We, of course, changed that. But so there's countries that this is lagging behind. I've been traveling a lot. So I also have a position with the U.S. State Department in their International Informational Speakers Program. And through that work, I've traveled a lot to Southeast Asia, to South Africa. And so basically where we have seen rapid population growth and this rapid economic growth is kind of where we're seeing this leakage. But it changes, right? Because that's all changing. And we wrote a paper, a white paper on the continent of Africa to say, you know, what is going to be happening here in the near future. So like Philippines, Indonesia, Japan, Vietnam are all places that I've been to talk about this issue with the State Department.
How are they receiving sort of the warnings or the information? Or I mean, is this changing thought? Is it affecting policy change from what your lens?
Yeah. So right away, you know, when some of the research came out, Indonesia created a marine debris action plan, and they're planning an aggressive reduction policy. We've seen resources go towards implementing solid waste management infrastructure. USAID actually created a program in countries that were in our research results to give funding again for developing waste management infrastructure. A lot of people, you know, kind of quickly reacted. And I think now we're sort of looking at what are going to be the best bang for your buck solutions. And right. And it's really an integrated approach like climate issues. It's not just one.
Absolutely. So it's not going to take one country that just becomes sort of the pinnacle of the right thing to do. It really takes everyone.
It takes everyone and a lot of different solutions in there. It's not just waste management because we need to also probably look and see, do we need product redesign? Do we need alternative materials? And what about reduction? You know, some places already are producing not that much waste per person in the U.S. We tend to do at least three, sometimes four times more as these countries in Southeast Asia. So we could probably reduce our waste generation some.
Well, and that was actually one of the things. The United States didn't kind of pop up on the worst list there, so to speak.
Yeah, we're number 20.
But we're certainly just our volume. I'm sure we're a big influencer. What's going on from your lens that you see policy-wise or community-active-wise in terms of the U.S. to improve this?
That's a great question. So there's actually an act in Congress called the Save Our Seas Act. It passed the Senate favorably, so bipartisan support, which is amazing. So the Senate hearing that I testified at was very friendly in terms of both Democrats and Republicans
and
supporting this issue.
I'm struggling to understand why it wouldn't have bipartisan support.
Well,
I'm sure it has some of those types of things like we see in climate.
It's not. It's definitely not the same. We do have this support, which is great because there's not very many issues right now at the table where you do have that.
Right.
So I think that's been a positive here, and then passed the House with some slight changes, so it's actually back to the Senate now for another approval. But so that's great at the federal level. We've seen, and that tells the State Department also to step up some more in terms of the international work, which I know a lot of this relates to these international issues. But also, we've seen a lot of states and communities do things. The state of California has looked at, they banned plastic bags, and there's more nuances than just to plastic bags being littered. They also are really hard to challenge in our waste manage in our waste management stream. They gum up the systems in our recycling facilities if people put them in their recycle bin.
What's your thought on recycling since you bring that up? Because it seems to be one of these things that has become a little bit murkier than perhaps it would be.
Yeah. And that was kind of our most recent paper, too. We were looking at the export of our recycled material, specifically the plastic material meant for recycling to China. And then China said, we're not taking this material anymore. So what you're seeing in a lot of this, in a lot of the industry in these situations is sort of the upstream consequences from that here. And it really made us think, what do we need to do to improve our recycling system if we were having to ship all of this to China? Because we just couldn't get it clean enough for the markets here. And there wasn't even markets for some of the plastic materials. So do we need to look at changing upstream design so we are using the polymers that have markets here and, designing things so that they hold their value? It's hard. The recycling it's having challenges. It's not totally broken, but they're definitely having challenges. I encourage people to recycle because the more material that's there, the more economically, you know, you have the economics of scale. So don't stop recycling. But we do need to look at how we can do things a little bit differently so we have more high value commodities.
And the reason I asked that question is because even in my own county that I live in here in Georgia, they recently stopped accepting glass. And so at first
surprised.
I was a little bit sort of upset about that. But then I started looking into it a little bit more.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's not, you know, there's some challenges there.
There is. So in these recycling facilities, we design them. There's a lot of conveyor belts and screens. And, you know, so we basically design these systems to mechanically separate all the recyclables that you can put into one bin to make it super easy for us at the household. But then the engineers, we have to design a lot of things. And glass tends to break and it can contaminate the paper stream. And then we also have the labels on the glass. Then the glass stream isn't very clean and it just doesn't have any value. And it's very heavy to transport. So any trucks driving, I mean, there's all kinds of things with the glass. But it's also one of the materials that we sort of, you know, it's historic and we sort of love it for the applications that it's been in. It's made from sand, you know, and it's not plastic. So, you know, there's a lot of people that like it. And why can't we recycle it? And it's just it's hard with the system as it is designed right now. I know there was like a kid in Texas who decided that his community stopped collecting glass. So he started collecting it himself and was just like, well, we can, you know, maybe do this. And if you do things separate like that, then it has a higher value.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
To the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard talking to Dr. Jenna Jambach, and we're both from the University of Georgia. And you brought along a bag with you today. And I know that you were on our sister's program, AMHQ, on the Weather Channel this morning. What are some of the things in that bag that we're finding in the oceans?
Yeah, so I brought a bag of trash and marine debris that we actually have found. So there are straws and food wrappers, toys. There was a flip-flop in there, broken sunglasses, cigarette butts, plastic bottles, lots of bottle caps.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's just an array of things. Now, you talk about some of the things, and I'm...
Oh, here's a contact case.
She's holding up literally in front of me right now, and I see all of the things that she mentioned, contact case, applesauce wrappers, just all types of things. And what about the sizes? Because you showed me some things earlier, and you've got a little jar here, and it just has really small particles in a little sort of jar. The jar is probably about... an inch and a half, 2 inches in size, in length. What's the implication of the size of the different things you're finding?
So what happens is that when the plastic enters the environment, it's exposed to sunlight and even like wind and wave action. And the plastic, then the polymer sort of breaks down, it becomes brittle, and then it fragments into these smaller and smaller pieces, eventually about the size of a pencil eraser is where we get to the level that we call microplastic. So we have these big pieces that break down into these small pieces, and that means that then smaller and smaller animals, and especially like you can see those little round ones here, those are actually the pre-production pellets. So those are actually what they ship around the world. That's how plastic is shipped
These pellets are about the size of a little BB or pellet or maybe a little sleet pellet for the Weather Geeks listeners.
And so these sometimes leak out and so these end up in our environment as well. And those are the pre-production pellets. So those actually look like things that fish like to eat. And so in many of these cases, animals get curious. We also even know that there's microbes that colonize the plastic that give off an odor of food to birds, so that gives them the, you know, the sense that this is actually food to eat. And so then they eat that. And so we just know that animals around the world are consuming this. Seabirds are one of the main species that really get impacted because they come down on the water and they, you know, skim the top. And that's where this some of this plastic is floating.
And I was going to ask you about that because you see these horrific pictures of, you know, marine life entangled in trash or, you know, animals, whales are ingesting this. The question I have, because we deal with this in the weather and climate world, we have critics that say we sort of are using exaggeration or hyperbole or scare tactics. Greenland's not really melting, or, oh, that Hurricane Harvey's not going to be that bad. You just want ratings. Do you deal with people that say, oh, pictures like that are just, you know, inflated or just hyperbole, or is it that bad?
Well, so I think those pictures are actual events that are happening.
Absolutely.
And so for that individual, you know, they, you know, in some cases, those birds are dying. The actual, you know, parent albatrosses are bringing back plastic and feeding it to their chicks. The whales are consuming the plastic bags. But certainly there's actual scientific research going on to say, you know, and of course, at the ecosystem and animal level, you have sort of these individual impacts that can be documented. And then you kind of go up the scale. Is there actually an impact to a population or a species and things like that? And so folks are still kind of working on those. But we know at some of these cellular level even and some of these various levels in these ecosystems that we're seeing some impacts. But, you know, this is really kind of a new research field that has really taken off recently. So kind of bringing all hands on deck to figure out what these impacts are is really the cutting edge. And then, of course, that goes into the potential impact to humans as well.
Absolutely. Now, sort of rounding out the discussion here, and it's been such a great discussion with Dr. Jenner Jembeck. Okay, what do we do? Are there any alternatives to plastic?
So there are alternatives. I mean, what we used to use before plastic as well as now, we're developing at the New Materials Institute at the University of Georgia, looking at biodegradable polymers, because in some cases that, you know, some of the advantages of plastic are there. It's light, it's, you know, moldable. I mean, all the reasons that we use it for so many things, it's a great material, but we just need to watch sort of where and when we use it and how we manage it. And that's what we really hadn't thought about before. But certainly reusable items too, right? So something that might even be plastic but reusable, as long as you're not sort of disposing of many things, that can be a way to go as well.
What about recapture? Can we recapture? Can we just get these giant sweepers? I mean, is that just pie in the sky type stuff?
Well, just because the ocean is 70% of our planet and how much is out there. And even if you look at the graphic we had, we estimated this 8 million metric tons going in, but only floating, you know, a quarter of a million. So because some of the plastic sinks, sure. And it ends up, you know, there's all these sorts of sinks. So actually going out and sort of cleaning up the surface of the ocean is a fairly small fraction of this.
Right.
However, fishing gear is one thing that does enter the ocean, and it's designed to kill. So that's something that when it's in the ocean, it's like, okay, we should probably get that out. But trying to vacuum up these small particles, you know, is kind of like mopping the floor of your bathroom while your tap is on. We really kind of want to turn off that tap and keep it from going
right.
in the first place.
That's a great analogy. So you're one of the top researchers in the world, top scholars on this topic. Where are you headed next with your own research? What's next for you?
Yeah. So I'm continuing to work with the State Department, sort of expanding my work with National Geographic around the world, and actually now starting to look at some of these more pulse events and looking at catastrophic events and the type of debris that's made with that as well.
You know, and when you say pulse events, you mean sort of a flash flood?
Yeah, like, well, yeah, yeah. So the stormwater events,
okay.
Yeah. And so that's kind of how we describe those.
What about sort of these large episodic events like a Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico?
Right. So exactly. That's actually where my research is going next.
Really?
To look at. And so we call them sort of catastrophic events in terms of the hurricanes, the tsunami. We know that the tsunami in Japan created a large amount of debris, about 5 million tons, and about 1 million ended up floating across and all the way across over to the U.S. So that can have an impact as well. And we want to understand all these sources. And so that's my next source.
And to me, this sounds like a fascinating frontier area of both not only ivory tower research, but this is research that affects society. So we are, thank you for what you're doing. How does some young scholar or kid that's listening to this podcast, what do they do if they want to do what you're doing?
That would be very exciting to, you know, inspire people to kind of go into this field. And it's great because it's interdisciplinary. So, yeah, I'm an environmental engineer, but you could be an oceanographer. You could be a marine biologist. You could be a product designer, a materials scientist, economist. We've got I just met a woman, a professor from Berkeley, who's a political scientist, then looking at sort of the potential international laws and regulations that we could have on this. So there's just about every discipline. We also need people in media and design to, you know, help design awareness campaigns. And it's a great interdisciplinary field. So just about anybody.
Right. I'm going to give you the full floor for sort of the final thoughts here. You're talking to the world, literally. What would you say?
Well, my goal kind of heading into solid waste initially was kind of to change the paradigm and the thought of it, and to think of this as materials management, and to make people kind of be okay and aware of the waste that we're generating. I think we've done a great job of designing and getting it away, and everyone just wants to get it to the curb. But I think if we can bring some of that awareness back to the waste that we're generating every day, that can help solve this problem, and just even be grateful for all the people that work on this issue. You know, as I was getting ready for the TV, we were chatting, and I was like, can you imagine if no one was collecting our waste, if we didn't have this system, you know, what it would be like? And just appreciating all the people that do this around the world, and then figuring out, you know, how to, you know, keep plastic out of the ocean. We all can make a difference.
Yeah, and I want to end it there. I think Dr. Jambeck is just a classic example, and I like to talk about this, of where research and development is actually aiding and benefiting society. I think a lot of times people see universities and research organizations as these highbrow ivory tower organizations. I think if, as you've listened to Dr. Jambeck today, you see that this work matters to you, your kids' lives, and our future. So I want to end it there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm Dr. Marshall Shepherd, and this has been the Weather Geeks Podcast.